Okay, this hour we're going to take your calls with Tim Ferriss, author of Tools of Titans. We're going to talk about a few more of those titans and then get to your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, back with Tim Ferriss, our final hour with him as we take your phone calls, talking about his work, Tools of Titans. Tim, give us a quick list of some of the people that you've highlighted in the book, some of the titans.
Some of the titans would include celebrities like Jamie Foxx or Arnold Schwarzenegger. Arnold also wrote the foreword to the book. Tony Robbins, billionaire investors and self-made entrepreneurs like Chris Sacca, Peter Thiel, Reid Hoffman, Hollywood wizards like Robert Rodriguez, athletes, iconic athletes like Laird Hamilton, mm-hmm. Gabby Reese, his wife, who's incredible, former Navy SEAL commander who is known by numerous presidents on a first name basis, Jocko Willink, and it goes on and on. Malcolm Gladwell. It's quite a cast of characters.
Any surprises for us?
You know, yes. There are some folks with names you'd never recognize, like say B.J. Miller, who's the M.D. I mentioned earlier. He's a triple amputee. He was electrocuted in college, lost three of his limbs, and he's a palliative care physician who's helped more than 1,000 people to die gracefully.
Amazing.
And I would say there are a number of people like that, a few top doctors, scientists who talk about cancer prevention, life extension, things like this that no one's ever heard of. So it gives me particular joy to bring those people into the fold and share what they have.
Was it difficult or was it easy to approach these people when you wanted to write this book?
Some of them were easier than others. It took me a year and a half to, for instance, meet up with Jamie Foxx and talk to him for 2.5-3 hours. For the vast majority of these folks, it's the first time they've ever had an interview that length.
For this.
And, okay. So some of them, Arnold Schwarzenegger took more than a year. Edward Norton took a year and a half. So some of them were definitely Marlin. You know, you gotta kind of reel them in, let them loose, try again, reel them in. So some of them took a long time to get in, but now that I've had them in, most of them have become quite good friends. So it's been a great process.
That's great. A lot of people these days, Tim, are under a lot of stress. They're just getting bombarded with so many things out there. You've had techniques for dealing with this. Why don't you give us a few pointers?
Sure. Happy to give a number of them. One would be a sleep remedy. And I really think that sleep, and Jodie Foster said, for instance, that at the end of the day, success is sleeping well. And I think that's worth pondering. It really determines the quality of so much of the rest of our lives. So here's a simple one. This is from, and it also dramatically reduces stress, of course, and cortisol to sleep properly. So here's a trick from Seth Roberts. He's a professor emeritus. May he rest in peace. He passed. His trick was 2 tablespoons of apple cider vinegar plus 1 tablespoon of raw honey mixed in hot water. And he did a bunch of experimentations with this. I don't know why this works so well, but it has worked for thousands of my listeners and readers. It is like a tranquilizer dart. So if I really need to nip insomnia in the bud, which I've had historically my entire mm-hmm. life, this is the cocktail I go to. I don't know why it works so well, but that would be one. Another one would be consider swapping your coffee, or at least one of your cups of coffee, with a tea. And the tea is very specific. You would get Pu'er tea. It's aged black tea. And add to it just a little bit of turmeric and ginger for anti-inflammatory purposes. Right. Also very good for cognitive function. And you steep that, doesn't take very long, 30 seconds, 60 seconds, and then add 1 or 2 tablespoons of coconut oil to it. And coconut oil, people want to see some fascinating drawings online, and you'll see where this is going. They can search Alzheimer's disease clock test, which is how many doctors will partially track the progression of the disease, because people get worse and worse at drawing clock faces, and coconut oil. So you search Alzheimer's clock test, coconut oil. And coconut oil contains, I won't get too deep into it, but something called medium chain triglycerides that are very good for brain function. So try that. Try some tea with a little bit of coconut oil. Those would be 2. I have dozens of these, but those are 2 that really help. And the last that I'll mention right now is something that cropped up again and again, which is a specific type of journal called the 5-minute journal. And it is effectively a super short 5-minute pre-game mental prep of journaling in the morning, and then it's a 5-minute post-game analysis at the end of the day. And this has been a complete game changer for a lot of my friends, those people who are hoping to become high-performing folks, or those who are already doing really well, who just want to be better. This addition has made a huge difference to them.
Does it just basically also make people better people?
I think so. I think it does, because I think if we're looking at better in the broadest sense possible, we're talking about self-aware and knowing thyself. And that's part of the reason, for instance, and I'm not sure if we necessarily want to go down this rabbit hole, but why two of the chapters featuring MDs and PhDs go into the subject of psychedelics, or as they might be called, entheogens these days, but these compounds that have been used for millennia by different civilizations that have been unfortunately politicized and neglected scientifically for probably the last 20 to 30 years.
Who would you have liked to have gotten for the book that you did not?
There are quite a few. I would say, and maybe this seems like such a given answer, but Oprah is just endlessly fascinated me for a very long time.
Very successful.
She's just where she started and how she reinvented herself repeatedly, and the fact that she was actively trying to put a positive dent in the universe and help people, unlike, say, some entertainers necessarily who have reinvented themselves. That's endlessly interesting to me. And then there's also a fiction writer, an incredible fiction writer named Neil Gaiman, who's a polymath and fascinating to me for many of the same reasons. He's jumped between multiple worlds and been very successful. And he seems to be an upbeat, happy guy with a good family.
Now, are most of these people from the United States?
I would say 90%, just by virtue of me being in the United States, but I would say 10% are overseas. Paulo Coelho, who wrote The Alchemist, who sold more than 100 million, he's in Geneva now. I interviewed him via phone. A number of people from the UK, primarily, perhaps a few in South America, but mostly a handful in Canada, our friendly neighbors to the north, but most are in the U.S.
And again, are those traits, though, similar, even with people abroad?
100%. And in fact, some of the odder habits that I've found useful, like I've ended up calling it star therapy, but questions that a number of people ask to reduce anxiety while they're looking at the stars at night, this has become a routine for them. They span from people in the U.S., B.J. Miller, I mentioned earlier, to Ed Cook, who's an incredible memory champion. He's a competitor. He can memorize a shuffled deck of cards in less than 60 seconds and teach people to do that very quickly. In the U.K., they're an ocean apart. They don't know each other. Exact same routine that they arrived at separately. So that's been really fun to see. The patterns of excellence transcend culture and language.
Okay, now, with these incredible traits of these individuals and the fact that there are similarities, very powerful similarities, were these people this way when they were kids, or did something happen to change them?
So I've tried very hard this is a great question, and I think it's one of the core questions. It is very seductive and unfortunately unproductive to simply attempt to learn from someone because they are a world-class performer. And the reason is you have to separate the people who are good at what they do because of God-given attributes, which you probably cannot learn or mimic, and people who have gotten to where they are because they've developed techniques and training that you can actually model. So most of the people in this book, for sure, just like all of us, have certain characteristics that they had when they were kids, they still have as adults. But I've tried to the greatest extent possible to to select people who have done more than you possibly could have imagined based on the raw materials they started with. So most of these folks have, and I would say they also were born with, just like all of us, plenty of flaws and weaknesses and insecurities. So I make it a point to talk about those too, because it's easy to put people on a pedestal and see them as these flawless examples of human excellence, and well, so-and-so can do it. Elon Musk might be able to do A, B, or C, but I couldn't do it because I wasn't born Elon Musk. And we only see the highlight reels on the magazine covers. But so I wanted to show some of the dark periods for all of these people and how they got out of them.
All right.
So that's been I think, a very important part of the book for me.
Great work. You seem like you're very happy with the results of the book.
This is the first book I've actually enjoyed writing. And it's just been a joyful experience. And so far, based on reader feedback, that seems to be the experience reading it. So I'm really happy with it.
All right, let's go to the phones. First time caller, Mark in Orlando, Florida. Mark, you're on with us. Go ahead.
Hi, George. It's an honor to speak to you.
I'm glad you got in. Thank you.
Years. Thank you. And welcome to your guest. And very quickly, I'd like to say to your guest, earlier you mentioned in comparison, or rather what people may have thought about certain candidates for office, and you used the Obama example and the Trump example, where people think negatively of Trump and how he's going to destroy America, so on and so forth. You also mentioned that people thought Obama would be the quote-unquote savior and fix everything, and he didn't. Well, I think it's disingenuous if we don't mention that he was blocked from doing a lot of good things for this country, for all of us. He was prevented from doing a lot of good things for us. So I think we have to mention that when we say things like that. Well, he didn't do this, he didn't do that. Well, he couldn't. He was prevented from doing a lot of good things for America. So that's all I wanted to say.
Okay.
I'm going to check out your book. It sounds terrific.
No, I appreciate it. And let me add just some commentary, which is I agree with you. I 100% agree with you. So I think we're actually on the same page here. And my point is just along with the fact that, let's say, Obama had many things he wanted to do, but he was prevented from doing, say, those top 20%, 30% of the positive things he wanted to do. For those people who fear that Trump will have this long list of horrible things that he'll want to put into motion, whether or not that's true, but let's just for the sake of argument assume that to be the case, I think he will similarly be blocked from doing the top 20 to 30% of those. So I think the pendulum just swings both ways.
West of the Rockies, Leroy is with us now in San Diego. Leroy, go ahead, sir.
Hi, George. It's a pleasure to meet you. I basically have a question for you guys. I'm basically an inventor, and I'm trying to invent a hoverboard, you know. Basically, I already have the plans and everything. I really don't know how to go about that. It's actually like the one to, like the Back to the Future hoverboard that you don't need to have.
Michael J. Fox was on.
Shroom. So that's my question.
How do you develop something? How do you develop a product like that, Tim? Most of these successful people have been very successful doing it, raising capital, and making things happen.
Yeah, there are different approaches. I would say that, and I do know a lot of product developers and inventors, I would say that not all product developers need to or should be business builders. And if you want to get a good grasp or at least an understanding of some of the options that are available to you from an intellectual property standpoint, from a licensing standpoint, from what they would call venturing, so building an actual company to monetize it, I would look into a gentleman named Stephen Key. So S-T-E-P-H-E-N, Key, and he has a company called InventRight, R-I-G-H-T. And I've spent time with him. He's prolific. He's very successful. And I would take a look at the options that he outlines.
If you were to write a sequel to Tools of Titans, what would you do differently?
You know, I always think about this when I write a book. If I were to write a sequel to Tools of Titans, and quite frankly, this is the first book I've ever thought that I might do multiple volumes of. I could see doing this every 2 years, honestly, as I keep doing these interviews. If I were to do it slightly differently, I think that I would probably I would love to add, and there are a lot of illustrations in the book, but I would love to add more graphical elements, number one. And number two, I would love to actually elicit, and I do have, I would say, 20 different micro chapters that are submissions from these world-class experts and performers writing of their own. I would love to actually elicit even more of that. So those would be a few things that I would lean on even more so. I gotta say, man, I don't have any regrets with what we ended up with.
Good for you. Good for you.
Yeah.
It would be interesting to look at the successful people who were of a certain age bracket compared to successful people of another age bracket. Maybe, you know, successful 30-year-olds compared to successful 60-year-olds, mm-hmm. and to see if there was any difference there. Because obviously the technology has changed. The 60-year-old didn't have the technology available that the 30-year-old does today, for example. Mm-hmm.
No, that's very true. And I'm actually really glad you mentioned that, because one of the things I'm hoping to do more of is interviewing people who may not be on this planet very much longer, who have a lot to offer in terms of expertise and experience. Because even though, and in part and parcel with that, I would like to interview people who got a late start. In other words, people who are best known for what they did, but what they did didn't happen until they were in their late 40s, 50s, mm-hmm. 60s. I think that's a really interesting untold set of stories. And there's so many people I would love to interview. For instance, there's this gentleman in Southern California named Don Wildman. I haven't met him yet. He's 82, I believe, or 83. He still does a month of heli-skiing every year and can do something like 20 strict pull-ups. And he's the idol of a number of these super athletes in this book, including Laird Hamilton. And I want to interview this guy before he leaves the planet. I mean, that is a national treasure. So I would love to hunt down more of those people.
You know, and one thing, Tim, I have found that a trait that is very successful for all people is those people who retire and do nothing, I think they tend to die earlier than people who just keep working or keep active.
100%. And I actually went to Japan to Ogimi, which is the village in Okinawa that has the longest average lifespan and also the highest percentage of centenarians, people over the age of 100, in the world. And I spent some time in Japan a long time ago. I speak Japanese, and I spoke to tons of people there. And even our driver, this is on your point, our taxi driver was in his late 80s and ran around showing us everything, and everybody was active. You saw people at the market who were going shopping, 95, 103. You saw people gardening in their 90s, well over 100. Everybody had a purpose and a task and something that gave them meaning. So I agree with you. I think as soon as you cease to feel like you have a role to play or a task or a meaning, then you opt out. And as soon as you opt out, I think it's just a matter of time.
All right, we're coming back for final phone calls in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Tim Ferriss with us, and of course his book, Tools of Titans. That's one of his books. He's got several others out there. The 4-Hour Series, The 4-Hour Body, The 4-Hour Work Week, The 4-Hour Chef as well. Go take a look at it. All those websites are linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. Okay, welcome back to our final segment here. Tim Ferriss with us, Tools of Titans. Tim, isn't it true that you created the book, Tools of Titans, to help yourself too?
I did. In fact, I never planned on publishing this one. I thought I was done with books.
Really?
And silly me. But I went through about 10,000 pages, literally, of transcripts and all my handwritten notes, and I wanted to create a Cliff Notes for myself so I could use it for my own life in these three sort of buckets, healthy, wealthy, and wise, because I'm also obsessed with Ben Franklin. And got about halfway through it and realized, okay, this thing is already a book. I might as well just do the extra 20% and get it ready for my readers. So here we are.
What did you learn doing the research for the book, doing the interviews, that you didn't know before?
Well, I'll tell you, there are a number of therapists and doctors who brought up a concept that really surprised me because it's so counterintuitive. When you're dealing with people who have, say, end-of-life anxiety as terminal cancer patients or people in really dire straits, they tend to battle big existential questions and big questions. Why me? Why now? What does it all mean? And some of these folks have found it very therapeutic to, for instance, give these folks, patients, let's say, a book of Mark Rothko abstract paintings. These are basically colored squares and rectangles. And to point out that it's possible to find beauty in something that is meaningless or purposeless. And those are thought of as universally negative things in a lot of respects, but you can actually find beauty and appreciation in circumstance, in serendipity, and so on, that may not have some underlying meaning that you have to search for to find. And I just thought that was very surprising and counterintuitive. So that's one that came to mind.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. Keith is in Rochester, New York. Hi, Keith. Go ahead.
I'd like to ask the author about the obsessive neurotic personality. Everything you said sounds very good and rational, but the truly neurotic cannot and will not get out of their own way. For them, the techniques you advise are like water off a duck's back.
Now, give me an example, Keith, of what you mean by the neurotic.
Well, these are the people who are truly unloved and unacknowledged. They are so low in their own self-esteem that nothing, and I'm comparing them now to the successful people that Mr. Ferris writes about, nothing probably that you could do would be able to reach into them and bring themselves out of themselves.
All right.
But they've been so beaten down, and they could just simply not rise out of themselves to those true heights of success.
What do you think, Tim? Those people who are so beaten down, that can they get up?
Yeah, let me address that. So I have a number of chapters in this book and sections for every one of these people talking about their darkest moments. And some of the people in this book nearly killed themselves. There are extended talks about depression. There are extended talks about self-doubt, abuses, upbringings in some cases. So I would argue, in fact, that for the beaten down, for the neurotic, I have my own battles with extended chronic depression, as do many people in my family, that these type of coping strategies and techniques are actually more important. That would be my argument.
And some people pull a cloud over their own heads, don't they?
I think all of us are guilty of that at points.
Sometimes.
And when I ask all of my guests, what would you put on a billboard if you wanted to get a short message out to millions of people? And, you know, one of the answers that I liked the most was don't believe everything that you think. And
speaking of billboards, don't you have some up there in New York?
I do. Yeah, this is mostly, I would have to say, for fun. I wanted to thank all of the people who had been interviewed in a way. So I took some of their answers to what would you want to put on a billboard. And there are about 80 plus billboards right now in New York City rotating their quotes.
Wow. 80?
Yeah, there are. It's just blanketed Manhattan. So there are some really good ones out there. There's some really good lines.
Do you mention who they are, the people?
Oh yeah, 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 absolutely. And it's been great to see their enthusiastic text messages and so on when they have fans who are taking photos of these things. It's really fun.
That's kind of neat that you do that. I've always had something that I've asked people. That when they die, what would you like your tombstone to read about your life? And that you get some pretty interesting responses that way, too.
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a fantastic question. I agree.
What would you like yours to read?
I think I would like it to read a teacher who always hoped his students would be better than he was.
I like that. Mine would be, he made a difference.
Well, also a great one.
Yeah. Let's go to Gary in Toledo, Ohio. Hi, Gary. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, Tim. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
You are such a genius at the 80-20 principle, separating out the things that make the biggest difference. Can you tell us about some of the things you've learned? And I also wanted to tell you that your books have changed my life and the lives of my sons.
Beautiful.
And you're a very, very humble man, given your extreme achievements.
Thank you. I really appreciate that, and makes my night to hear that about you and your son. So let me give it a shot. So
you touch people, Tim. It happens.
I'm doing my best. And this is what keeps me going. Writing is actually really hard for me, so this is the kind of stuff that keeps me going. You know, what I've learned, so the 80-20 principle, I won't go too deep into right now because I know we're tight on time, but I will say that what I've learned is that people who are really successful, meaning they achieve a lot, and those who are also at peace with themselves are good at asking different questions than the rest. And one of those questions, well, there are two questions that I found very helpful that I've borrowed from other people. So one is, what would this look like if it were easy? Because I think we overcomplicate a lot of our projects, a lot of our relationships, a lot of our decisions. So what would this look like if it were easy? I know that might seem impossible, but what would it look like? And I'll journal on that for a page. Another one, if I'm feeling very indecisive, or if I have many different projects on a to-do list or tasks and I'm feeling really overwhelmed and underwater, I will ask, which one of these, if done, will make the rest easy or easier or irrelevant, meaning I don't have to do them at all. So those are two that I think encapsulate the 80-20 principle, and also something called that I discussed at some length in my first book called Parkinson's Law. But those are, I think, the power is in the questions. You can judge a man by the value of his questions or by the questions he asks. That's a Voltaire quote, and I believe that. I think that reflects your thinking. So the better your questions, the better your thinking, the better your life.
How important is positive thinking, Tim?
I think positive thinking is important, but that by itself it is dangerous. And this comes back to the Stoicism that I mentioned so long ago. The Stoics and many of the people in this book are very good at anticipating and describing for themselves what the worst case scenarios could be, so that they can become either comfortable with what could happen in advance, much like that quote that I read to myself from Marcus Aurelius, I will encounter surly, rude people today. Okay, I am now mentally prepared for that so that I don't wander into an ambush feeling like Pollyanna and get my face ripped off by messy reality. So
exactly.
I think that positive thinking is important, but there's a quote, this is an old one, probably a few, 1,000-plus years old, from Archilochus, and I'm paraphrasing here, but it is, we do not rise to the level of our hopes, we fall to the level of our training. And I think that, like anything else, you have to train and condition yourself in different patterns of thinking, different patterns of acting, different patterns of exercising, and so on. So you fall to the level of your training.
Was Marcus Aurelius really suffocated by his son, or was that just in the movie?
That's a great question. You know, I'm more familiar with the demise of Seneca than I am of Marcus Aurelius. That's a great question. I don't know the answer to that.
Check that out. I'm curious now.
All the Stoics generally end with some type of horrible catastrophe or suicide. But, I mean, that's actually requires some explanation. I won't get into it. But suicide is thought of in a very different way.
In these titans that you've highlighted in the book, what will their ending be like in terms of, based on history, based on successful people? Have they passed happy or not?
Well, this is I think the question in some respects, which is why if I had written this book 10 years ago, I think that healthy and wealthy would have been the two sections. The reason that the third section, wise, is the longest is because I think that success without happiness is a Pyrrhic victory. That is a loss. And if you can't be, the short answer is most of the people in this book, I think, do check the happy box. And for type A personalities, it takes practice and using, for instance, the 5-minute journal that I mentioned, or learning to be aware of their counterproductive thoughts through some type of using Headspace, for instance, an app for meditation, very, very easy, very simple to follow. If you don't want what you have, nothing you get will ever make you happy, if that makes sense. So I think it's a practice, and everybody in this book on some level is working on it or has figured it out for themselves.
Let's go to Linda in Alaska. Welcome to the show. Hi, Linda.
Hey, George. You're again a champ. This is Linda, Alaska.
We're keeping you awake.
I need to know Tim Ferriss' spelling of his name.
All right.
And I want to tell him thank you. I've got a friend who's beginning to complain that she has insomnia. And Tim, thank you so much for throwing out 2 parts apple cider vinegar, 1 part honey, and a whole bunch of hot water just before bedtime. And
off you go. All right, Tim, spell your last name for Linda.
Sure. So it's Tim, T-I-M, last name, F as in Frank, E-R-R-I-S-S. So like Ferris wheel with an extra S on the end.
And how about another question, Linda? Go ahead while you're here.
I sure do. Now, I can get your book at any bookstore. If I tell them that I want that book, I give them your name, exact spelling, and the exact name of the book, Tools of Titans.
And they order it for you, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah, they should absolutely be able to order it. You can get it anywhere. I was just going to say Amazon, Barnes & Noble, everybody should have it.
Yes, sir. And you know something, what you did extra special is oftentimes when I hear stuff like this that's important to me or important to a friend of mine that I happen to know about, they say, oh, the answer is in my book. But you threw that one and a couple of others.
He gives
out
the answers. That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Good observation, Linda. A lot of guests.
I just know how I would want to be treated as a listener, so I try to do the same. So thanks for listening.
So what kind of clothes should we wear? Well, it's in my book. But it's always good to give somebody a technique and a tip and things like that. You know what would be interesting? If you had a conference with all the people that you highlighted in Tools of Titans, I wonder if they'd all get along.
Well, it's funny you should ask. So about a year ago, I invited about 100 of them to an event simply to let them meet one another. It was not a public event. And they got along famously. So you would have a world-class surfer next to a chess prodigy, next to a music producer, and they had a lot of common ground. So these people you'd never expect to potentially bump into each other in the street, when you put them in the same room, they did get along. Everybody got along famously, because I think there are common habits and routines and beliefs among these top 1%. And I should also emphasize, you know, the earlier caller talked about how these are these outlier folks and none of it applies to neurotics and so on, that these people all started at zero. They started at zero. These people started in the same place. These are not people who were born into massive inheritances. These are self-made men and women.
They didn't have the golden spoon given to them.
They did not. They were not born with the golden spoon.
Let's go to first-time caller Steve in La Crosse, Wisconsin now. Thank you, Steve, for calling. You're on the air with us.
Yes, good evening, gentlemen.
Hi.
I wanted to ask a two-part question. How many scientists are on the list of Titans? And in particular, I had the pleasure of taking a astronomy course from J. Allen Hynek.
Oh, you had the best. You had the best.
I had the best. Interest, Highlights of Astronomy, it was called. And he spent several days on UFOs. And as you know, he started out as a debunker.
That's right.
Didn't believe in it. But eventually he became a believer. And, of course, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. He actually appeared in that movie.
Yes, he did, with his pipe.
And I was, right. Great movie. And you know, it was probably the seminal work about UFOs, at least that was depicted in film. I'm just wondering if you've heard of him, and if he's not in this book, maybe in the next one.
And he's no longer with us. I assume, Tim, the people you highlighted in the book, are they living or dead?
They are all living, with the exception of the one PhD from Berkeley, who unfortunately passed away. But everyone else is still living.
Yeah, Hynek passed on several years ago. But are there any scientists on your list?
There absolutely are. I have a science fetish and am fascinated by research. So there are neuroscientists, there are many different researchers who study metabolism, cancer, longevity, and lifespan in different mammals and humans. There are a lot of scientists. And it's written, I think, in an entertaining way, but there are definitely some top minds from the world of science in the book.
Well, it sounds like you had fun doing it, that's for sure.
I had a blast.
All right, Tim, I want to thank you for being on the program. Have a great holiday, and if you need anything, you know where to find us, okay?
Thank you so much, sir. I appreciate the time.
Tim Ferriss's website's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. In the book we're talking about tonight, of course, Tools of Titans. Now, in a moment, we're going to come back with Mike Bearer. We're going to talk about his thoughts and theories about the secret space program, an incredible story all by itself. And yes, it's an interactive show. That means the last hour of the show, we open up the phone lines to give you an opportunity to chat. Now, there are still so many people who've been on hold waiting to talk to Tim. We have run out of time. I'm sorry. But keep trying. Keep trying. You'll get in. We'll be back in a moment with Mike Bearer and the Secret Space Program next on Coast to Coast AM.